Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent shares details of the latest Pentagon briefing on ISIL. An analyst considers Egypt's election.
You need to have an opposition in order to produce debate, accountability of those in power, choices for the voters.
We'll hear about a major announcement in the run for the White House. And we look to see if a 26-year-old movie actually predicted the future is right here on The Voice of America. CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command, has held a briefing on the intensifying conflict in Syria and the war against ISIS. A Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb, was there, and she joins us now on the line. Welcome, Carla.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. Who was conducting the briefing, and what was said in general terms about what's going on in Syria?
The situation in Syria is continuing to intensify now that Russia is involved. They said that Colonel Steve Warren was speaking to us from Baghdad, and the coalition said that they've seen the Syrian regime act more and more in the last couple of weeks north and south of Aleppo. And if you've noticed, the Russian airstrikes have been focusing in that area, as well as Hama and Homs. The U.S. and the U.S.-led coalition say that the Russian airstrikes are still not hitting majority Islamic State territories. They're mainly hitting places controlled by the opposition, and that is further deteriorating the situation in Syria.
Well, what was said in general about the overall fight against Islamic State?
Well, there have been some gains made. The situation in Ramadi, Iraq, has been slowed, but the Iraqi security forces are still making progress, according to the coalition. Interesting news out of Beji. They said, Colonel Steve Warren said that the Iraqi forces have now gained most of the oil refinery. The U.S. and the coalition had four airstrikes in the last week there, and people were questioning why so few airstrikes, because when a major operation happens, usually the United States and coalition will ramp up their airstrikes. And Colonel Warren said that they weren't needed because the Iraqi Air Force had carried out 40 missions in that area in the last 3 days, which was a very positive aspect from an Iraqi security force that has been facing a lot of criticism lately, especially after being kicked out of Ramadi earlier this year. So they are continuing to focus on Iraq and focus on the Syrian rebels. He gave us an update and said once again that the Syrian Arab coalition that was airdropped different ammunitions a couple of weeks ago had received all of their 100 bundles, which is a massive amount of ammunition, by the way. They had received all of the ammunition and was using it against the Islamic State.
Is there any hint the U.S. may get further involved in Syria, maybe even boots on the ground?
Well, it's funny that you asked that, because that was brought up today in the briefing. There has been an announcement that the United States is going to be bringing in some A-10 aircraft and bringing out some F-16 aircraft. So, of course, people start to speculate, well, what does this mean? Does this mean there's going to be a new operation? Well, Colonel Warren said today that was basically because the F-16s had been flying over Iraq and over Syria for months. They just needed the regular maintenance, and said they were bringing in A-10s. But it is interesting to note that there are more A-10s coming in to Turkey's Incirlik Air Base than the F-16s going out. And a lot of people are speculating, Colonel Warren would not say one way or the other, but a lot of people are speculating that this is happening in anticipation of the Canadians bringing out some of their F-16s. Some of their F-18s, because the Canadians, now that the Liberals are partners to the North, now that the Liberal Party has won that election, a lot of people are saying that the Canadians are going to pull out of the 60-plus member coalition fighting against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
Well, thank you very much, Carla.
Thank you for having me.
The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria has proved itself to be most adept at recruiting members and targeting adversaries through social media. International Edition's Ira Melman reports on a symposium on the issue presented today by VOA and the Newseum.
Two possibilities were detailed by Lorenzo Vedino, who directs the program on extremism at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University.
Basically undermining from a theological point of view, from a personal point of view, the different fallacies in ISIS ideology and theology. The second part is going after ISIS ability, to be so good on social media, and that also entails a variety of actions which are very complicated. I suspect that one of the reasons why we heard earlier from the State Department that we've seen less propaganda coming out over the last few months is because there has been a targeted campaign against some of the top ISIS propaganda people with targeted assassination on the ground in Iraq and Syria.
We'll also add this
never-ending debate on whether we should take accounts down or not. Right. There's an intelligence value in keeping them up. Right. At the same time, keeping him up, obviously, as a radicalizing power.
Another of the symposium's panel was Baroness Emma Nicholson of Winterborne, a member of the British House of Lords and chairman of the Amar Charitable Foundation. She says another possibility is to supplement digital media with face-to-face contact, something she was able to do with a small group of Yazidi girls who had been captured by and then escaped from ISIS.
But thanks to everybody's kindness, I and the Amar team managed to bring three young Yazidi victims to London. I had them give evidence in camera to the committee I chair in the House of Lords, which is a committee to prevention of sexual violence in conflict. But even more importantly, perhaps, they made three very small films, little videos, in which they told their stories. And their stories were bad enough on the video, but of course, in reality, they were a thousand times worse. The real story
was horrific,
utterly stomach-churning. Heaven knows how these girls are alive and how they got out at all. And those videos we've managed to take to some of the schools. And we managed with one school to take the young ladies with us to the school, wrapped up their faces, because, of course, with all the social media, ISIL kills or hurts any captive family member that they may have, and they've got family members of almost everybody. So we managed to take them to one of the schools, which in a sense was a source, if you like it, for young people getting excited through social media on ISIL, and maybe even going, because we've lost about 1,000 young people from the United Kingdom. We took the three young ladies, showed a little bit of the video, and I have to say that the young people were stunned, silent, devastated. And then, one by one, two boys got up, one by one, one clearly a Muslim, one I think probably not, and they apologised for the whole male sex for what had happened. And then the girls started to get up. I think there's a reality that is missing in social media. I would suggest it's not so much social media we have to get to, it's actually face-to-face.
In addition, Nicholson said people in areas now occupied by ISIS need access to outside sources of information. You can find more on the symposium at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Over the past few years, researchers have made tremendous strides in making prosthetic hands more lifelike. While scientists are getting close to making artificial hands perform as well as natural hands, one area that remains a challenge is replicating the sense of touch. Engineers at California's Stanford University answered that challenge and have created a plastic skin that can detect how hard it is being pressed and then produce an electric signal that will provide that sensory response directly to a living brain cell. The skin is made with two layers of plastic. The top layer acts as an input device that senses the touch and the intensity of the touch. The bottom layer is like an electronic circuit board that sends electrical signals and converts them into biochemical stimuli that are compatible with nerve cells. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Many experts agree that the record low turnout in the Egyptian parliamentary elections indicates that many Egyptians, especially young voters, are completely withdrawing from the political process, with a rampant perception that the new parliament will not advance a transition toward democracy in Egypt. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy is following the story and joins me now for some analysis. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Mohammed, if the low turnout was a silent protest, what kind of message did Egyptian voters send to President Sisi, who promised a return to democracy through an elected parliament?
Well, the message is clear, Sue. Egyptian voters have very little confidence that the new parliament will represent the public interest, but rather support the president and will not exercise even an oversight of the government. Amy Hawthorne of Program for Middle East Democracy explains why Egyptian voters see it that way.
just from looking at the types of people, candidates, parties, electoral lists that are participating, there really isn't anyone who I'm aware of who is running in these elections who is opposing Sisi or strongly opposing his policies in any way. It seems that those people have either been excluded from running as candidates or chose, you know, on their own will not to take part. And so, therefore, this parliament wouldn't have any possibility of having any real opposition in it.
Hawthorne noted that the election law earmarked 75% of the parliament seats for independent candidates and thus weakened the idea of parliamentary blocs and transformed the upcoming parliament into a parliament of interests of individual members.
Mohammed, a pro-Sisi party list called In the Love of Egypt, headed by a former intelligence general, is emerging as the winning bloc of parties in the first round. What does all that mean?
It means that Egyptian voters were right when they expected a relatively pro-government legislature, which may refrain from even exercising the powers mandated by the new constitution for a strong parliament. And according to Amy Hawthorne, that will add more skeptical outlook for democratic transition in Egypt.
It's a basic ABC of democratization, of process of democratic change, that you need to have an opposition in order to produce debate, accountability of those in power, choices for the voters, some kind of real policy discussions. And there is no opposition in Egypt today. It's not allowed. And so, therefore, you'll have a parliament of many individuals, all of whom will support President Sisi in one way or another. It's just a further development down the road of returning to authoritarian rule.
Hawthorne expects that a lot of Egyptians, especially young people, will stay away from politics, thus serving a deliberate strategy by President Sisi that depends on people being apathetic and not participating. But she warned that this is a very dangerous path.
When you have an authoritarian government and a struggling economic situation and no meaningful outlet for peaceful opposition, then it leads to an explosion. And so right now, I'm not sure what the paths are for peaceful political change. The frustration that exists in Egyptian society has to express itself somehow. And so the Egyptian government would be wise to ease up on the repression and allow more people to take part in political life without creating such a narrow space for legitimate participation.
Amy Hawthorne said, "It is important for the international community and the United States to speak out about what's really taking place in Egypt and not to endorse that undemocratic path."
Well, thank you, Mohammed, for this perspective.
Thank you, Sue.
Coming up on International Edition, Biden spills the beans about his plans. And did Back to the Future predict the future? U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has announced at the White House that he will not seek the Democratic Party's nomination for the presidency. Joining me to talk about the decision is national correspondent Jim Malone. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. This announcement culminates weeks, maybe even months, of speculation about whether or not he would run.
Yeah, it was quite a scene in the Rose Garden just a little while ago at the White House. He came out with his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, and President Obama to make the announcement that he believes that the window has closed for him to make a serious run for president. Of course, he's trying to balance his family needs to get over the death of his son, Beau Biden, in May, with the urgent calendar needs to get going a presidential campaign if he wanted to run. And he's just simply decided he ran out of time.
Well, what does this mean for the Democratic Party hopefuls, especially Hillary Clinton?
Well, it means probably quite a bit. There have been a lot of uncertainty hanging out there with a possible Biden candidacy, a lot more unknown factors were he to get into the race. She already has a strong challenger in Bernie Sanders. But last week, she had a strong debate performance for the Democrats. And in fact, her poll numbers have been bumping up a bit now in the polls. And now, without Joe Biden entering the race, it looks like it's going to be a choice between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And the gap is sort of expanding now between the two of them. Doesn't mean it won't change. Doesn't mean that the race won't be still difficult for her in some ways. But I think this is a huge boon for her coming off the debate performance and now Biden's decision not to run.
And tomorrow is going to be a big day for Hillary.
Yeah, it will be a big day. She makes an appearance before the House Benghazi Committee looking into the terrorist attacks in 2012 that killed four Americans, including the U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens. Now, of course, leading up to this, there's just as much scrutiny about the committee because of some comments by Republicans that it's politically targeting Hillary Clinton. She has seized on that to try to make a political circus out of it. Nonetheless, you never know what can transpire during this sort of grilling of the former Secretary of State about what went on before, during, and after the Benghazi attacks. So we expect to see quite a bit of activity on that during a very, very long hearing on Thursday.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jim, for stopping by.
You bet.
Okay. Joe Biden's announcement has triggered a huge jump in the number of people talking about him on Twitter. And Michael Lippin is here with that. Michael.
Hi, Susan. Well, I've been looking at the analytics website Topsy, and it shows that in the last hour alone, the vice president's last name, Biden, has been mentioned more than 82,000 times on Twitter. You know, that's an average of 22 tweets per second. So perhaps it's not surprising that Twitter shows Joe Biden to be the number two trending topic, both here in the U.S. and worldwide. The only topic ahead of him is hashtag Back to the Future. That's a reference to the American science fiction comedy films that were big hits from 1985 to 1990. Susan?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
There are 300 million smokers in China, and now by age 20, two-thirds of young Chinese men are smoking cigarettes, increasing their chance of premature death by 50%, according to a new study published in The Lancet. Researcher Zhengming Chen at the University of Oxford says that cigarette smoking in China has accompanied the country's economic growth.
Since, you know, 1990s, with the rapid economic development opened up, and China suddenly produced a very large quantity of cigarettes.
The study's authors say that if the trend continues, by 2030, as many as 2 million Chinese men will be killed by tobacco each year. By contrast, smoking rates among women in China have dropped sharply. About 10% of older Chinese women smoke, but only about 1% of middle-aged women are lighting up. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Movie Vans, 26 years ago, saw a film that sparked the imagination of what life might be like just a couple of decades into the future. The day in that movie is here, and so is International Edition's Jim Stevenson.
October 21st, 2015. This is the day in the movie Back to the Future 2 when the main character Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox, arrives in the future from 1989. Now, many fans of the movie have been waiting for this actual day to arrive, and now that we are in the future, what did the movie get right in predicting our current life, and where did it fall a little short?
The future.
To start, the headsets worn at the dinner table resemble what we know as Google Glass and a few other competitors. Flat-screen TVs are a reality, as is video conferencing through computers and smartphones.
Hey, stop! Little girl, stop! Look, I need to borrow your hoverboard.
Where is it?
Yes, there's that matter of the hoverboard, a skateboard that floats on air, but not water, as Marty finds out when he's being chased.
Hey, McFly, you bojo! Huh?
The boats don't work on water!
Unless you've got power!
By the way, car company Lexus recently introduced a hoverboard that utilizes magnets and superconductors to defy gravity. It even emits steam due to the science behind the superconductors at work. The Lexus model won't be for sale, though, but this development does lay the groundwork for future hoverboard technology to eventually become a reality. Flying cars? Not even the fancy DeLorean that brought Marty to 2015 is off the ground today, although there are some manufacturers now vying to develop cars with wings.
This is a video game! I got it working!
My dad taught me about these.
It is Wild Gunman.
How do you play this thing?
I'll show you, kid. I'm a crack shot at this.
Your hands? That's like a baby's toy.
In a humorous moment, Marty saunters over to show some young kids how to play an ancient video game until they totally diss his skills. Perhaps there's a local arcade near you that features vintage games you could pump some quarters into and give it a try. One of the boldest predictions from the movie, the Chicago Cubs beat a team from Miami to win baseball's World Series for the first time in more than a century. You know, in 1989, there wasn't even a team in Miami, as there is now. And the Cubs are in baseball's playoffs right now, close to reaching the World Series. We'll have to wait for that to play out and see if Back to the Future got that right. Back to the Future 2 is indeed back. It's in theaters today to mark the occasion. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In its annual Religious Freedom Report to the U.S. Congress, the Department of State noted three strong trends in 2014. First, the most egregious and violent cases of persecution based on religious intolerance were perpetrated by violent extremist groups, who seem to be bent on eliminating any religious practice that differs from their narrow and violent ideologies. Second, some governments failed or were unable to protect their populations from abuse by such violent groups. And finally, some governments restricted religious practice or speech through the use of discriminatory laws as well as arbitrary arrest, imprisonment, even execution. Around the world, a number of violent extremist organizations sought to murder or enslave any group or individual not conforming to their narrow interpretation of religious precepts. This included, among others, Daesh, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, and Boko Haram. The damage done by such groups was exacerbated by the failure of some governments to act quickly enough or at all to protect the victims. Some governments claimed to be the protector of religious minorities, but failed or were unable to stop religiously motivated extremist attacks. Others failed to prevent, stop, investigate, prosecute, or punish religiously motivated violence, creating a culture of impunity. Worse still, a number of governments passed and enforced laws that punished religious minorities or discriminated against certain religious groups. Laws against blasphemy and apostasy were used to persecute and exact grossly excessive punishments, up to and including death, in the name of protecting majority religions from insult. Still other governments persecuted and punished practitioners of certain religions under the guise of combating extremism and terrorism, or forced religious groups to officially register and abide by a very narrow set of regulatory laws. Religious bigotry is present to a degree in every continent and every country, and sadly, even including our own. It may be expressed through anti-Semitism or prejudice against Muslims, through the persecution of Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, Sikhs, and others, or it may come in the guise of attacks against religion itself, said Secretary of State John Kerry in his introduction to the Religious Freedom Report. By issuing this report, we hope to give governments an added incentive to honor the rights and the dignity of their citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.